Today on Words on the Wire, we have Leticia Hernandez Linares, who is a San Francisco-based Latina spoken word poet and artevista. Hernandez Linares has created work at Brava, Women for the Arts, La Peña Cultural Center, Galería de la Raza, and some arts are performed throughout the venues in the United States, including Intersection for the Arts and Poets Cafe in New York City, The Loft in Minnesota, and numerous other venues. She's received the William Carlos Williams Prize for the Academy of American Poets in 1996 and has taught university courses in women's studies and creative writing. Leticia Hernandez Linares, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Are you kidding? It's like this is one of the books I've been waiting for a long time, waiting for this to come out, you know, waiting for this to happen. So congratulations on your new collection of poetry, Mucha Muchacha, out with the Achucha Press. How does it feel?
Thank you. Yes, I've been waiting for a long time as well. So I feel relief. I feel just total joy and like everything is perfect for me. Right. Not that I'm saying it's a perfect book, but for me, I'm at peace with it. You know, I was ready to be like, okay, it's ready now.
Yeah.
And that's a great feeling because I definitely, it was a struggle to get this first book out. And now I know I've kind of like opened the floodgates and I get it. I get my process. I'm ready to do this now. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, actually. You know, I just been working on a manuscript lately, too. And I want to say, I think on Facebook, I posted like in the last year, two or three times when I said, I'm done. And then I go, no, I'm not. And then, you know, and then, I do know what you mean. But your first like chapbook, right? It was Razor Edges of My Tongue back in like 2002 or something.
Yeah.
Right. With Galaca
Press.
Right. With Galaca Press, which they did amazing things back in the late 90s and even early 2000s. They did some wonderful work in the community. But between that collection and this one, you know, there's been like a span of 13 years or so. So what have you been up to?
Wow. Are you going to ask me my age next? I'm ready for you.
Way to put a number.
I know, that's right. I know you've been doing like performances, you've been making art, you've been recording music, raising a family, teaching.
Yes.
Oh, what else have you been up to?
That's so funny. You're lucky we go way back. I'm just kidding. That was a good save, by the way. Thanks for scaffolding that for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Been raising a family, and I've always been very active in, you know, spoken word and performance, and, you know, that's always just kind of been the regular, but I think at some point I realized, I need to really focus and figure out what my goals are for myself, because I was always so immersed and prioritizing community, the community work I do as an educator, but also community building through the arts. I had started at the same time that I put out Razor Edges of My Tongue, I started a women's poetry and performance series, and it was only an annual event, but it was a pretty big event for a one-woman production.
Yeah.
And it kind of grew every year, and finally that, as it grew, I also grew because I sort of learned more about how to apply my nonprofit skills onto my art. So fast forward, that kind of shifted into the 10th year I closed it and started to get grants for projects I wanted to do with other, you know, collaborate with other artists, but with my vision in mind.
Right.
So one of the examples of that was a project I did called, the project itself was the Dar a Luz project. And I wanted to write about my experiences being pregnant and becoming a mom and my early to late 30s and what that is like as the daughter of a teen mom and what it's like in the spectrum of Latina motherhood. So that project was about a two-year project, and I produced new work, new poetry that I'm hoping will be another book in the future. And
nice.
Alongside teenage moms in my neighborhood who go to school at the, you know, sort of continuation school for them, then we did a big multimedia performance. It was really fantastic, but that's an example of the kind of project I've been involved in throughout, you know, this time. And I've also been, you know, publishing in journals and anthologies and things like that. But it took me, I was very distracted, shall we say, on the way to this book. And then I had to first hammer it out sound-wise before I could, you know, wrestle it onto the page.
Right.
So there's where the CD came in, and the CD was first, and then the Arts Commission here in San Francisco has been a huge resource and support for me in my project. So I did the CD, and then I edited what came into the, you know, the first version of the real manuscript, and I spent like 5-6 years editing that thing.
Wow. Yeah, and it shows. I mean, you know, the work is really tight. The whole collection, it's tight all the way through. That's one of the things. Yeah, and I'll get to that in a second, actually. You know, we'll break that down in a little bit here. But, you know, one of the things, and I know, too, that, you know, your husband, Tomas Riley, who's also a fantastic poet and artist and community worker in his own right, is there with you as your partner, and your family's always politically engaged there in the Bay Area. So, you know, I know that you've been really kicking butt on all this. So congratulations to you, and congratulations on this wonderful book.
Thank you.
So yeah. So the title "Mucha Muchacha." What did
that
tell
is
us
a
the
great
story?
Title.
Yeah,
I love that title.
Yeah. So tell us the story behind the title. I know that there's two poems in the book that you know to do with that, but what's the story behind the title? Why that?
I heard the song by Esquivel. Right.
Mucha Muchacha.
Yeah. That's very cute. Very good, guys. You should
that's how we
that
do
on
it.
The road.
That's right. We'll break out in song.
Yeah, that's what we do.
You know this from just performing together, but also in general, like my sort of process begins with music a lot of the time, whether it's songs that I create myself or songs that inspire me. So I heard that song, and, you know, a lot of the writing I do is actually about my grandmother, but I kind of scaffold it so it doesn't come off as a, you know, abuelita poem, as they say.
Sure.
But she is definitely the inspiration to a lot of my stories. The stories that, you know, inspire me, but also that I tell. And so it just kind of reminded me, because she was kind of a, you know, she came over from El Salvador in her 40s, and she's kind of a party girl, you know, like she had gotten divorced, and she loved to have her some parties. And I remember those parties
awesome.
At her house. It was great. And, you know, she did, you know, like domestic work. She cleaned houses, but she would go in her very colorful polyester clothing and, you know, her heels and her rings. And so she was just like this crazy mix of a role model, you know?
Right.
And so when I heard the song, it really triggered the memories of those parties. So there was a lot of music and dancing. And so, but I also really irked me because it was so annoying, you know, like too much girl.
Too much girl.
Me muchacho, too muchacha. Let's muchacha together, you know? And it's just like, even though it is Mexican and everything, or was, it just was like annoying. But it was just a perfect thing because, you know, I've always been the loudest person in a room, or the angriest person at the table. Or
not you.
You know what? I know you can't tell that, Anna, right? You're really shocked about this information about me. And so I just decided, like, to own it, because it's like, yeah.
There's no other way to be. Poets are just loud, man.
You gotta own it.
It's true. And then when you put the sort of Latino on top of that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
My mom, my aunt, and I are all, right, yeah. My mom, my aunt, and I, when we were together, when my sons were babies, when we would all laugh the same carcajada at the same time.
Yeah.
And it would scare the children.
El cuartel de risa.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
In case you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the Bay Area poet and cultural artivista, Leticia Hernandez-Linares, about her new book, Mucha Muchacha. I want to actually get into the sort of nuts and bolts of the book a little bit because, you know, one of the things that you start off the book with the poem Underneath the Cuento, and if I can, which you write, splotches of skin interpret and keep time with the story she is going to tell you. And then you go into the second poem, which is Learning to Talk, where you essentially, it's kind of like you're breaking down how Spanish and English play a role in your work. And I felt like this was excellent structure to the book. And, of course, I'm thinking of this right now because of my own book. I've been, like, structuring it and figuring all that. I'm going, yes, this is great structure. So I guess this is a question about structure. And I want to teach it. Like, you know, I want to teach it. It's just a wonderful – I mean, it's a great structure that you have
awesome.
There. It's a great way to set up the book and for what's about to come throughout the rest of the book. And so, you know, tell us a little bit about your process. Like, are you the type of person who puts, like, all your poems out on the floor and looks at – how do you work on structuring the book?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't do that whole, like, paper my floor with the papeles, although that's a very cute picture on Facebook that people like to post. I'm just kidding. I think everybody needs to have their own process for sure, but I think, you know, some of these poems have been walking around with me for a long time, and so I think it was really about the two negotiation processes, right? One was about being at peace with the performative and spoken word aspect of my work and not silencing that. And at the same time, also owning that the amount of Spanish in my work. Mm. And it was a huge, in terms of structure, it was a really big deal and really exciting for me to make a decision and say, I'm not going to put a glossary at the back of the book because there's just too much Spanish. And I'm like, this isn't a Spanish lesson. You know, it's just not, you know, I just made a decision. I just did it. And so, I think in terms of, I mean, the process of the book, I don't know. That's a huge question, but, I think what I did like about, and I did get, you know, support, like I did ask people to, you know, give me editorial, like kind of guidance as well. And that really helped too, because it nudged me to be like the too much girl poem was in the back.
Because
that's a big departure for me, and it's also very personal because it's about my really traumatic experience in graduate school on the East Coast in the early 90s. And one of my editors was like, oh, no, you need to put this at the front because this is important. This is everything you're about. This is your whole thing. But it's in sort of the language of the you know, for lack of a more creative term, oppressor. She's, do this, you know. So in terms of putting it together, it was really sort of understanding the three aspects of the book, which was sort of the language play, the music, and also the testimonio, which has been the scariest part. Even after all this time, I'm so much more comfortable telling other people's stories than exposing my own.
You know, and you mentioned some of these actually originated as spoken word pieces, you know, and can you explain a little bit what the definition of spoken word is just to you specifically?
Sure. And you know, I actually have never called myself a spoken word artist or poet. I don't mind if people call me that, but I've always purposely not, because I felt like somehow that sort of took away from me as a published writer and someone who also works on the page and who wanted to publish books. And that was just my thing. But so for me, it was before I really understood what Floridanto was in the sort of Chicano history classes, it really was what I grew up in. You know, my father was a musician. My mother did ceramics. Like, I was surrounded by, and he was also a wallpaper hanger, so he did, you know, manual work, but it was creative manual work in a way. So I was surrounded by so many different genres. And so then I moved into from dance to theater. And so in terms of my definition, my long-winded way of defining, answering your question is that it really was a space for me to take all of myself into my word, you know, and so I was able to make it fun, make it theatrical, involve and include song, and you could get the whole experience because it was about hearing it and the testimonio of it rather than the sort of publication and you know, and the quiet delivery of it. So for me, my performative poetry is about pushing boundaries of what people expect poetry to be. Because so many people be like, oh, yeah, I don't like poetry. Or they have expectation of what it's going to be. And then I do it for them, and they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't know poetry could be like that.
Absolutely,
that's right.
Yeah, like the mom, like I'll never forget that piece you did about the pig. Was that like in the late 90s, early 2000s?
The pig and the ice pick, yeah.
That was amazing. I just felt like I really felt how akin we were in our art making at that moment. That was an incredible piece. But just, I lived that pig killing in that moment with you. Anyway, so I do love it when someone says to me, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that. I'm like, that's right.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I remember doing these performances with you in San Francisco back in the late 90s and all that. And me driving all the way up from Fresno, where I was living at the time, you know, and obviously the Bay for me was like a magical place for poetry and art. And we would read there in the Mission, or sometimes we read over, I remember at Cafe International on Haight Street. Do you remember those times? Yeah.
And La Peña.
And La Peña, yeah, and those places in Berkeley. It was great. It was just a great sort of period and scene. But you know what? That sort of prompts me to ask this other question. How has poetry or the art scene there in the Bay Area, or specifically the Mission District, how has it changed or evolved over the years?
Well, you know, I actually am happy to tell you that there is a lot going on that's specifically kind of Latino-led, thankfully. Like, you know, we have the Lunada that, you know, this is probably where you and I maybe even met in San Jose.
Right.
that Mark Binate brought over from when he was at Galleria about, I don't know now how many years ago it was since he's left the Bay, but but then Sandra Garcia, who was also a longtime friend and, you know, poet and community worker here in the Bay, she took it over, and so she's really kept it going, so it's going really strong. So we have the Lunada, and she was here when I arrived, you know, and she was here in the 90s, and she was a big part of the scene before she kind of left for a little while, and so... So the fact that she's the one leading the Lunada, I think for me, as somebody who's been in the Bay for 20 years now, like, it's just a huge deal that that's being, you know, preserved and continued. And then, you know, a bookstore called Alley Cat Books, which is connected to a lot of small sort of, there used to be one in, like, a bunch of neighborhoods. Now there's only, like, one or two left. But the two, ironically, the two that are left are both in the Mission. So
oh, wow,
a
dog-eared
book.
A dog-eared,
Alley Cat, and the Alley Cat has been very community oriented. A longtime amazing Mission based artist, Michael Roman, has a lot of work up there regularly, and they have a gallery, and so some reading series is propped up there as a result of our estimado poet laureate, Alejandro Murguia. So him being appointed was huge, you know, like I was really honored to be there and celebrate with him, and he really did take it like, this is for the community. This is about me. And so he started with some students a reading series at Alley Cat. And some other poets have been beginning and sort of running things here and there. So in terms of poetry specifically, I feel like it's thriving. There's strong. There's a bunch of readings. I'm going to read at the Studio Graham, which is a new, somewhat new space in Oakland. At another reading that Susie Huerta runs, I don't know if you're familiar with her work. So she started a series there, and I'm reading with Lucia Corpi, which is amazing.
Oh, that's great! Wow.
Like, I still remember the day. I remember everything about the day I was reading Delia's song. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was like 1993.
Wow!
And that's how much it struck me. Like, oh my God! Like, this is my life right here. You know, like my hashtag I often put on Facebook is like, we still live here. Like, they haven't kicked us out completely.
I know, because there's been, you know, with all this sort of gentrification that's been going on there in the Mission and the whole Bay Area, actually, it's kind of pushed a lot of people over to the East Bay and beyond, you know. You know what, on a similar note, when I read your poem, Despierta, it reminded me, I love that poem, by the way, and it reminded me so much, and I thought, why do I love this poem so much? And for a lot of reasons, for its own merit, but also because it was reminiscent of a poem that was written by our current U.S. Poet Laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, a poem he wrote called Mission Street Manifesto. And to me, your poem was like, it has its own concerns regarding that neighborhood, and it's sort of set in a new time, obviously, in a new generation. But, you know, what perfect mission these streets have become, shoveling out plots for graves, plots for sale. I loved it. And so, and then I thought, I wanted to make sure I asked you that, you know, how gentrification has affected the arts there in the Mission. But I think you kind of answered that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of people have been displaced. So these series are happening. A lot of people come from the East Bay to the series. The Mission has never been solely about residents. Like, you know, like Alejandro doesn't live in the Mission. He lives in the Bayview, but, you know, he's from here, you know, so it definitely has affected us, but, you know, it's a strong fight that's happening. You know, it's interesting about that poem is, like, I actually really like that poem, too. It's one of my favorites of mine.
Yeah.
I think because it was the first time I was able to shift a little bit into talking about things like, you know, like the challenges in the neighborhood, but to do it a little bit differently than I normally did.
Right.
And yet, this was still a while back. Like, I mean, the stuff I'm writing now about what's happening now, it's, like, so much more severe and urgent, and yet exactly the same. You know what I mean?
Right, right, yep.
Because we've basically been going through cycles of gentrification since the 90s, it's just now reached an obliteration level. Like, literally right now on Valencia Street, and Valencia Street was always the kind of, like, it was always hipster, like, even, not always, but, like, since the 90s, it's been, like, the kind of, there was always a shift between Mission Street and Valencia Street. But Valencia Street has been so, like, sort of deformed, you know?
Mm.
And right now, there's about 5 stores, small businesses on one block that are all going to close or have been closing within days of each other.
Wow.
Yeah,
crazy.
It's really, like, intense. It's intense.
And then on a sort of another note, you know, I've been listening to your tracks on Reverb Nation. I know that you're a recording artist also, and you have a beautiful singing voice. We're looking out for a Grammy next year. No, you really have a beautiful recording voice. You do, and it goes so well with your poetry. Or before I even saw the quote by Mercedes Sosa in your book, I thought of Mercedes Sosa when I was listening to your voice.
Oh.
And I thought of like Violeta Parra, and I thought of even some of like Marta Gomez in there. Like, you know, just these kind of, who are your musical influences?
You just named them.
Did I? All right, so I was dead on.
Yeah,
nice.
You were dead
good
on.
To know.
Well, you know, because, you know, my dad, he played in an English language rock band in El Salvador called Los Lovers in the 60s.
Nice,
and
Los
he was
Lovers.
A big, right. And he was a big hippie, you know, and so he his hair was longer, was as long as mine is now,
smile.
When I was born. Yeah, he was. So I grew up in this really, like, you know, but he was, you know, a Latino hippie. So it was
a little different.
It's a little different, yeah.
Yeah, a little different.
Yeah, smidget, right? And, like, and then he hooked up with all these Chicano, like, hippie aztecas, you know, in East L.A., and then he was in a band with them for a while. And so I grew up around, like, you know, Nuevo Canto and, like,
right.
Chicano rock and... Mm. And he was really into folk music, like English language folk music.
Oh, wow.
So, that's such an interesting,
you know, I would get along with your dad.
Yeah. He has an incredible vinyl collection. Like, that was a regular activity that we would listen to his records. And it was my dad who introduced me to Peter Tosh, you know,
nice.
Lady Smith Black, Mombazu, like,
wow.
All this incredible music that I was around. But it was really the folk singers that I, because of, I guess, the key that I'm most comfortable, which I couldn't tell you if I was on a quiz, but I do definitely kind of, like, lean towards that aesthetic. So, yeah, that's definitely between the political sort of, like, focus of that art making and the sound of it, it definitely is my main. That's why I have a poem to Mercedes Sosa in the book, because when she passed, I never got to see her live.
Yeah.
So when she passed, it was right near when I was doing one of my women's series. So I dedicated that year to her.
Oh, nice,
and,
nice.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you had to pick one, would you consider yourself a singer first or a poet first?
Oh, my God.
That's so hard. Why do you ask that question?
I don't know. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's what I'm supposed to do. They told me that.
You know what you just did, right? You know, you just did the whole, like, are you a woman first or Latina first?
Oh, is that what I...
Wow.
Oh, man.
I think that they go hand in hand, right? It's something that's very... That flows in and out of each other, I would think, right?
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think for me, because... You know, my dad used to tell me stories about Roque Dalton, like, running away from, you know, people in the neighborhoods and those kind of stories. Like, poetry really was a communal and political thing always.
Right.
And in that same way, it was, like, something that was, you know, poetry. Like, you know, the Chicanos and the civil rights movements, they did Soricantos. Like, it was always a thing where there was, like, music and audience and community. It was never something that just existed in a book for us in our traditions.
So we've been speaking with poet and cultural activist Leticia Hernandez Linares about her wonderful new collection of poetry, Mucha Muchacha, out with Tia Chucha Press. Leticia, would you do us the honor of reading a poem from your book?
Sure. Since you asked about the title, I think I'll share Mucha Muchacha, but I need a favor.
Sure.
So I usually, when I do this at a poetry reading, I do it as a call and response. So it goes, when I say mucha, you say muchacha, mucha.
Muchacha.
Muchacha.
Eso.
All right.
Mucha.
Muchacha.
Busy hands collect nine lives. Religious trinkets mark each act of the play, trying to bury her with translucence and saint names. Zoraida's rings bang an anxious entreaty back and forth over dusty surfaces. Mucha.
Muchacha.
Waking old under the city's respiratory system, she inhales a quiet daybreak. No feet shuffling, no smell of a man's clothes. Rubbing brass Buddha's belly, she mutters prayers under dimly lit statues, sends telegrams on barbed paper. The bare minimum, just enough money, at some point, salvation. Mucha!
Muchacha!
Zoraida fills the empty spaces with invitados, and elbows crowd into a tiny house. Carcajadas spilling over, arms extended. Mucha.
Muchacha.
Muchacha. Gossip wedges thick under heels, gathering around little story appetizers, liquored sweet confessions. Esa Pilar holds court. draws a red heart around her gap-toothed smile, packs her purse with details about fulanitas y no lo van a creer. Blue-trimmed envelope sides torn open, pour bomb-stained skies out. Adorn the morning bus ride as Zoraida digs Q-tips into loyal lipstick tubes she just can't bear to discard. Back home, money, marriage, a house with solid walls, anything but broke-ass dirt poor, you hire a muchacha, a girl to do your work. Girl and work stick like nuegados en miel, panela melted, smothering too much, mucha muchacha, it's just too much, girl. Facing each sunrise, ready to lift herself, pull children up by the collar, stand them before glass promise of possible, Zoraida's doors skip heartbeats, sacrifice yearnings into shoeboxes. Too much, girl. When the professor she used to clean for attends granddaughter's graduation, laughter erupts in her chest. Her cheekbones pop with possible, blooming with disappeared dignity dug up from the molten. Hands blurred in continual applause as her girl dons cap, gown, awards, sharp tongue. Professor, what do you know about this mucha muchacha? Mucha!
Muchacha!
It's just too much, girl.
Wonderful. And that was Leticia Hernandez Linares reading
Leticia,
from her
you
new
have
book.
Me tearing up in the studio right
yeah,
now. That's
amazing. Yeah. Oh, thank yeah. you for that.
The it's energy is high in here. So thank you so much, Leticia, from reading from your new book, Mucha Muchacha, and we wish you all the best of luck for that.
Oh, thank you so much.